Executive Director of Centro Presente in Boston. I'll be speaking in Aliso Viejo in Orange County, California, Wednesday night at Soka University. Check our website. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communication Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. This month, our meeting of the KBOO Board of Directors will be on Monday, October 29th from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. at Cider Riot at 807 Northeast Coote Street in Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Art of Fawn with Impact on Saturday, November 3rd from 6 to 9 p.m. at Lewis and Clark College in Portland. Art-a-thon with Impact is a 12-hour creativity and wellness festival. Young people are invited to participate in groups. In 8 hours, each group will create an original artwork that is connected to themes of mental health and wellness. A festival from 6 until 9 showcases all performances and artwork open for all to attend. Again, that's the Art-a-thon with Impact on Saturday, November 3rd, from 6 to 9 p.m. at the Agnes Flanagan Chapel at Lewis and Clark College, 0615 Southwest Palatine Hill Road in Portland. More information may be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Thank you for listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K220 HR Hood River at 91.9 FM, K282BH Philomath at 104.3 FM. It's KBOO, your community radio station. The time is 5:01, and the KBOO Evening News is next.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, police respond to the Glass House Tavern after reports of gunfire.
Local LGBTQ community and civil rights leaders respond to the Trump administration's memo.
And in international news, Brazil votes on Sunday in the decisive second round of its presidential election. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, October 23rd, 2018. I'm Annette Newell.
And I'm Kyle Carrezzi. Police rushed out to the Glass House Tavern at 97th and Sandy Boulevard around 1:30 this morning after reports of gunfire. When they got there, they found a man on the sidewalk with at least one gunshot wound, who they pronounced dead at the scene. While they were investigating, a local hospital reported that a man came in with a gunshot wound, who investigators believe was also in the tavern shooting. Sandy was closed from 95th up to 102nd for several hours before opening back up. As of this time, police have not made any arrests. They are asking anyone with information to call 503-823-0479.
Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler believed people would be killed during political demonstrations last June after the Mack stabbings, according to the Oregonian. Fights and the prospect of more fights between protesters and riot police caused lots of concern for Wheeler, the mayor said. The American Civil Liberties Union filed a class action lawsuit after the protest, saying the police were overly aggressive and violated protesters' civil rights. Wheeler attended the deposition that lasted 2.5 hours at City Hall in July as part of a federal suit. The Patriot Prayer Rally and counter-protest, during which police corralled protesters, took place only 9 days after a man stabbed to death two men and maimed another on a Mack train. The victims were slashed after they stood up to an Islamophobic rant the man directed at two teenagers, one of whom was wearing a headscarf. Wheeler told the ACLU lawyers he was on a plane to London when he learned about the attack, and he quickly flew back. ACLU lawyers questioned him in detail about police policy and whether he personally dictates police tactics. They asked Wheeler where he was during the June 4th protest. In his testimony, Wheeler said he, quote, provides broad overall direction and strategy to the police, but delegates all command and control authority to the police chief. I don't call tactics, he said.
Officers at the riot used pepper balls on protesters and corralled and photographed hundreds of protesters in a tactic known as kettling. Given the heightened emotions following the stabbings, Wheeler said, quote, "I thought it was an extremely volatile situation," unquote. Wheeler said he had no formal role connected to the June 4th protest and was present at the police command center that day only to, quote, "observe, to listen, and to watch," and was, quote, "generally staying out of the way." He said he could not recall taking action in response to a city report that found police unjustified in corralling protesters. His conversations about crowd control with police leaders were very general. In his deposition, Wheeler said he believed that in connection to Gibson's rally, quote, "the potential for widespread civic unrest was very, very real."
Basic Rights Oregon hosted a press conference in response to the trans memo from the Trump administration. The memo outlines a proposal to federally define gender as only male or female and determined at birth. The conference speakers were local LGBTQ and civil rights leaders. KBOO reporter Kyle Carrezzi attended the conference. This is a speech excerpt from House Speaker Tina Kotek.
Thank you, Kieran and Azul and Nancy and the entire team here at Basic Rights Oregon for all the great work you're doing. My name is Tina Kotek. I'm Speaker of the Oregon House. I use pronouns she and hers. Oregonians should be deeply concerned about the proposal that we have been hearing about from the Trump administration. I can tell you I'm worried. I have constituents who are worried. I've had emails in the last 24 hours expressing concern and fear from the transgender community here in Oregon. The new proposal of redefining gender from the federal government is has put a lot of people in a very difficult spot. They are worried. They don't know what it means. It is the most far-reaching attempt by the Trump administration to roll back protections for transgender and gender nonconforming Americans that we have seen to date. We will not let the Trump administration tear down our community. And for those who right now are very scared about what this means, please know that my colleagues and I in the Oregon legislature will do everything we can to protect you, and Oregon will protect our community and our members here in our state. But let's be clear, this proposal is nothing more than fear-mongering. It is anti-science, and it is political games in the worst case. This policy contradicts expertise and science of major medical organizations around the country. This policy stands in opposition to legal precedent and existing federal policy. And this policy is an insult to the lives of transgender and gender nonconforming Oregonians. Here in Oregon, we believe in leading on transgender equity. Oregon is a state that passed comprehensive non-discrimination protections in the workplace, in public accommodations, in housing, based on sexual orientation and gender identity more than a decade ago. We are a place that has created the nation's most comprehensive education guidelines so that every transgender student in our public schools receives access to safe and affirming education. Oregon is a place where we passed a law to simplify our existing name change and gender amendment process on our birth certificates to be less expensive, more private, and safer for transgender Oregonians. And in Oregon, we are the first state in the nation to provide a third gender marker, X for not specified, for state driver's licenses and ID documents.
That was Tina Kotek, the Speaker of the Oregon House. The proposal outlined in the memo will not impact Oregon state legislation, such as the Oregon Equality Act of 2007. Critics call it a fear-mongering tactic before the midterm elections. Should the proposal take effect, it will likely hit education and health care first.
Today, the Political Action Committee opposing the Portland Clean Energy Initiative was accused of misleading a business owner into signing a statement of opposition to the initiative. Liu, the owner of King's Omelets, wrote a letter to the Keep Portland Affordable PAC demanding that they stop using her likeness and false statement. Con Pham, director of Immigrant Organizing and the Asian Pacific American Network of Oregon and a member of the Steering Committee for the Clean Energy Initiative, says that the PAC stated that they would take down her picture from the website. However, her picture is still on the PAC's blog page, though she is not quoted in the blog post. Liu does not want to be contacted by news media, but Pham spoke to KBOO this afternoon and described the accusations.
The opposition came to her and misled her to believe that she was signing on to a different ballot measure, and they did not mention the Portland Clean Energy Initiative or explain to her what the Portland Clean Energy Initiative was about. So she signed it under the impression that she was opposing a groceries tax, and they proceeded to use her name and her picture on their website, and they wrote up a statement in opposition to the initiative in her name, and that she was never able to see that statement, but they used her name, and they even misspelled her last name, but they've proceeded to use it in both their website, the voter pamphlet, and also in sponsored editorial content on the Oregonian, which looks like an article but is actually, you know, paid advertising. So, in, you know, they've really used her as the face for small business opposition to the Portland Clean Energy Initiative, when in reality there are very few, if any, small businesses that have agreed to stand up in opposition to this measure, because they know that actually this doesn't affect them and that will actually help them by building a stronger local economy.
Keep Portland Affordable receives its support primarily from the large, often out-of-state and global retailers that would be affected by the measure, like Amazon, Kroger, Home Depot, and JCPenney, among others. The PSA currently has little over $80,000 in contributions, having already spent almost $400,000. Fan expressed concerns with the PAC's behavior as it seeks endorsements from immigrant business owners.
Immigrants who don't speak English as their first language are often particularly vulnerable to being manipulated, and it's really distressing to see the opposition campaign use and deceit and mislead a small immigrant business owner and a voter, in this case, in order to achieve their means. You know, I really think democracy depends on truthful, I mean, you know, people have to know the truth in order for democracy to work.
That was Khan Pham with the Asian Pacific American Network of Oregon and part of the coalition supporting the Portland Clean Energy Initiative, which will be on the November ballot as Measure 26201.
A report released by the Downtown Portland Clean and Safe District paints a rosy picture of its efforts to, quote, clean up the downtown business area. Clean and Safe provides a number of services in a district that covers most of Old Town, Chinatown, and downtown Portland, as far west as Southwest 11th Avenue. Among those services are contracting out security services, often to former and current police officers. 2018 has seen a number of efforts, including the city strengthening and recommitting to its no-sit policy to clear so-called transients and panhandlers from the downtown business district. That's the language used in the report, the district's annual business census and survey. The report found that businesses listed transients and panhandlers as the number one and two factors that need improvement in the district in 2017. Those two undefined groups of people have occupied the top two spots in that category every year since 2010, ahead of both the cost and availability of parking. The report also found that a record number of people, just over 100,000, are employed in the district, with the top three sectors being tech and professional services, financial services, and food and accommodation.
For a look at what to expect at this week's city council meetings, we go to KBOO's Sam Bowman.
Tomorrow and Thursday, the Portland City Council will meet to dispense with city business and hear public testimony. The elephant in the room will be the mayor's proposed ordinance allowing the police and permitting authorities to severely limit the duration, mobility, and spontaneity of protest events in the city. The ACLU of Oregon and other groups have raised concerns about how the proposed changes will impact citizens' constitutional rights for free speech and assembly. The ordinance does not appear on this week's agenda, however, so the elephant will remain in the shadows for at least another week. Tomorrow morning, Council will declare October 2018 to be Filipinx American Heritage Month, and they will hear invited testimony on a new rule requiring city employees to disclose outside work, as Multnomah County employees are already required to do. Don't get too excited, though. Portland police officers and lieutenants will be exempted from any new ordinance in favor of the disclosure policy already found in their collective bargaining agreements with the city, which are much less transparent. On Thursday afternoon, the council will also proclaim October 2018 to be Disability Employment Awareness Month, and vote on whether to initiate work on an overhaul of the city's TV and film permitting office. The council will also have a hearing on Thursday over a permit filed by Imago Dei Church in inner southeast Portland to expand its parking lot. A neighbor is appealing the city's approval of the permit, saying that it will require the removal of an old black pine tree in a neighborhood already devastated by Dutch elm disease, among a number of other issues with the permit. The appeal also mentions that Imago Dei did not mention in their permit application that the expanded lot may be used to provide camping space for people without housing. This is based on an interview given by one of Imago Dei's elders, Ben Sand, to Coin TV back in June, in which he said that the church would like to use its parking lot for that purpose. The hearings officer who reviewed and approved the application said that he was not allowed to consider the, quote, possibility of a future camp on the lot because it was not proposed formally in the application. The neighbor appealing the permit says that Imago Dei's application mentions only day use for the parking lot and says that the Coin interview is, quote, evidentiary of the applicant's true intent, unquote. Imago Dei is currently one of a handful of locations in the Portland area that provides space for emergency severe weather shelters during the coldest parts of the year. The Thursday hearing is scheduled for no earlier than 2:30 p.m. For KBOO Evening News in Portland, I'm Sam Bowman.
Researchers have announced recently discovered faults on the north and south flanks of Mount Hood could cause a catastrophic earthquake. The discovery was made by Ian Maiden of the Oregon Department of Geology and Mineral Industries and Ashley Strigg, assistant professor of geology at Portland State University. They say the faults pose another risk to the region along with the Cascadia subduction zone off the coast. The researchers say the Mount Hood faults could produce an earthquake with a magnitude of up to 7.2, which is stronger than a quake in 1989 that struck San Francisco, devastating the city. Portland would also be closer to the epicenter of a potential Mount Hood earthquake than San Francisco was to the epicenter of the 89 quake, so the damage could be much greater. It's also worth noting that the mountain faults differ from those off the coast. The mountain would cause a crustal earthquake as opposed to a subduction quake caused by the faults off the coast. Subduction quakes are deep below the surface and last longer, sometimes as long as 7 minutes, but are lower in amplitude. Mount Hood would cause a much shorter quake, somewhere between 20 seconds to a minute, but it would be much stronger. Were an earthquake to occur from the mountain faults, the communities of Hood River, White Salmon, Cascade Lakes, Locks, and Government Camp would all see major damage. In Portland, there would be strong ground motion, and areas near water could see ground soil liquidation.
Members of Oregon's Fire Marshal Green Incident Management Team are returning home from Florida tomorrow after a 14-day assignment to help with the hurricane relief. They should arrive in Oregon by noon. In Gulf County, Florida, they help to restore power, water, and transportation, as well as supporting search and rescue and other emergency operations. They also spend a day loading a truck with 1,300 meals to deliver throughout the county. The team received a surprise visit from Florida Governor Rick Scott. He thanked the state of Oregon for their response and service.
Tribal leaders and the head of the Sierra Club are among those praising Oregon Governor Kate Brown's plan to sign an executive order permanently banning offshore drilling in Oregon. Earlier this year, the Trump administration announced a plan to expand drilling leases across 90% of the U.S. outer continental shelf, including the entire West Coast. Governor Brown says she thinks that's a terrible mistake. She says, quote, "This executive order will make it clear to oil and gas speculators that Oregon is not for sale." Brown is working with Senator Arnie Roebelin of Coos Bay and Oregon's Coastal Caucus to pass legislation in 2019 to strengthen protections from offshore drilling. Michael Bruin, the national executive director of the Sierra Club, joined Governor Brown for the announcement. Kate Brown is setting an example for governors all over the country about how to protect their coasts and their communities from Trump's dangerous plan, Bruin said. Alicia and Elkie Littleleaf, enrolled members of the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs, also expressed their support, saying, quote, "We rely on clean water and we rely on the salmon to return every season to feed our families, inspire our communities, and help power our economy. So we can't allow big oil companies to bring giant oil spills like Deepwater Horizon and the Exxon Valdez to Oregon's coast." Oregon U.S. Senator Ron Wyden also applauds the decision, saying Oregonians and visitors should never have to, quote, worry about big oil wrecking the state's natural treasures.
This week marks the opening of an exhibit about 200 years of beer history in Oregon. The Oregon Historical Society presents Barley, Barrels, Bottles, and Brews, 200 Years of Oregon Beer, starting this Friday. It traces back to the Lewis and Clark Expedition through the 19th century European immigrants who started the state's first breweries to today's craft brewery revolution. The exhibit profiles the people, companies, and laws that have made Oregon an innovative center of craft brewing of the hoppy beverage, now a cornerstone of the state's agriculture and economy. Oregon is now the second largest hop producer in the country. Visitors will also be able to smell some of the hops that were developed here in Oregon. They will also use a digital interactive display to help find out what variety best suits their taste.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on honest elections. The Portland Campaign Finance Reform Charter Amendment is on the ballot. Will it rein in campaign spending in our elections? At 6, it's preference. Then at 7 o'clock, listen to Calculated Conversation. Tonight's weather, mostly cloudy. A 30% chance of showers early, down to a low of 48 overnight. The clouds continue Wednesday, up to 62 for the high. Then a good chance of rain on Thursday, up to 60 degrees. Today in history takes us back to 1952. Ukrainian-born microbiologist Selmart Waksman won the Nobel Prize for Medicine for discovering an effective treatment for tuberculosis. Our quote of the day is from American television personality Johnny Carson, who was born on this date. He said, quote, "Thanksgiving is an emotional holiday. People travel thousands of miles to be with people they only see once a year, and then they discover once a year is way too often."
And with the election 2 weeks away, KBOO's Al Khan wants to ask you to vote.
Okay, it's time for all of us to vote. By all of us, I mean all of us. More people did not vote in the 2016 election than those that did. Why did this happen? Well, I've heard non-voters say things like, "My vote really doesn't matter," or, "I like him, but he just can't win." That's horse hockey. If you vote for him, he can win. If you vote for her, she can win. Don't be tricked by the corporate media. They are all owned by the big money elite. The most important thing for you to do is to vote. Your vote does make a difference. A vote is like a drop of water into a glass. You vote. Your friends vote. Watch the glass fill up. This year, there are some extremely important ballot measures. One poses a challenge to Portland's sanctuary city status. And another could affect a woman's right to choose what she can and cannot do with her body. This is the time. Right now. I'm asking. Please vote. Talk to your family. Talk to your friends. Implore them to vote. The hourglass has been flipped, and the sands are running out. I'm Al Khan, and I thank you for your attention.
The union that represents Border Patrol agents across the country, the National Border Control Council, is featured along with white nationalists and anti-Muslim extremists in a video titled "Killing Free Speech." The unions endorse the video, which runs almost an hour and a half and refers to Democrats as dark and evil. In the video, far-right extremists speak of a correlation between gang rapes, Islam, and immigration. Also featured in the video are the Proud Boys, who were prominent in the deadly Charlottesville Unite the Right rally last year and have also been involved in violent rallies here in Portland. The video was directed by Michael Hansen, who calls himself the Dane. He's a Danish immigrant who also directed another video called "Killing Europe," in which he argues that immigration has led to an epidemic of rape in Europe. Union Representative Terrence Schigg calls the video a powerful spotlight on the terrifying assault on liberty in America today. Schigg says Hansen first approached the union last summer at the height of the controversy around child separation and discussed the union taking part. According to Shig, Border Patrol agents were tired of being called names such as Nazis and jackbooted thugs, and Hansen was giving them a platform to speak out directly to the people. The union did not contribute any money for the video, but sponsored a screening in San Diego and expects to screen it also in Texas, Los Angeles, and Washington, D.C.
After 40 years in prison, Mike Africa is finally out today. He was paroled from the SCI Phoenix prison complex this morning and reunited with his wife, Debbie, who was paroled earlier this year. Both Mike and Debbie Africa were arrested on August 8, 1978, for the death of a police officer who many claimed was killed by police gunfire during a siege on their Philadelphia house that was their home, along with 10 other adults and 11 children. The home, known as the Move House, was riddled with gunfire that day as police fired more than 10,000 rounds before Police Commissioner Samber offered the house to be bombed, or ordered the house to be bombed, excuse me. 2 1-pound explosive devices were dropped on the roof of the house. The explosion ignited fuel from the gas-powered generator on the roof. The fire spread throughout the building, trapping the Africas in the basement. 6 adults and 5 children died in the fire, as Philadelphia Mayor Wilson Good told the firefighters to, quote, "let it burn." The fire destroyed an entire city block and left more than 600 people homeless. Today's parole of Mike Africa is a dream come true for his son, Mike Jr., who was born in a cell and raised by relatives. He had never seen his father outside of prison or his parents together before. With the release of Mike Africa, thoughts are turning to the Move members who are still in prison. Petitions are filed in federal court for Janet Africa and Janine Africa, who both have good prison records but have been denied parole. The siege and bombing of the Move home remains a stain of the city on the city of Philadelphia. The Move organization still exists, mostly in the greater Philadelphia area. It mixes revolutionary ideology with caring for nature and the environment, and keeps up the fight for the release of their family behind bars.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Tribal leaders at the National Congress of American Indians Annual Convention, taking place in Denver, Colorado this week, are expressing concerns over allegations of sexual harassment at NCAI. On Saturday, the organization's executive director was put on leave as an internal investigation takes place. Rhonda Lavaldo reports.
As the historic 75th convention of the National Congress of American Indians began this week in Denver, Colorado, tribal leaders were voicing their concerns on the recent allegations of staff misconduct within the nation's oldest and largest Native American organization. Cecilia Flores, tribal treasurer for the Alabama Coushatta Tribe of Texas.
We haven't been given a lot of details. I haven't heard a lot of details on it. There seems to have been some delay in handling the situation. Like I said, I don't know exactly all the details of it, but I am supportive of NCAI have brought it to the attention to the tribes. You know, if something inappropriate did happen, I would fully support them in whatever steps they need to correct that issue.
George Tiger, chairman of the United Indian Nations of Oklahoma, Kansas, and Texas, spoke about fellow Cheyenne River Tribal Chairman Harold Frazier's statement on the need for an independent investigation.
It's a protection factor whenever you can get someone that's independent of the organization, of the membership, whatever the case may be, that no one with any ties to NCAI should be able to come in and make that type of a investigation, that kind of a, evaluation, because only then would it be a fair evaluation. I know that Harold is very adamant about this, and knowing him personally, he won't give up. He'll make sure that those things are going to be addressed in a way that is going to satisfy Indian country. Right now, even in the comments that President Keel made, that they're making an effort to do that, but still yet that question still lingers, why so long?
Tiger also spoke about the prioritization of tribal issues and influence of corporate money that need to change. This is Rhonda Lavaldo for National Native News.
Recreational marijuana is now legal in Canada. The law allowing it came into force last week. And as Dan Karpinchuk reports, Indigenous groups are hoping to reap some of the benefits of what's likely to become a multi-billion dollar industry.
Across the country, there were celebrations on the day that anyone 19 or older could legally purchase recreational cannabis. Most provinces have either government-run stores or regulate private business. And much of the cannabis bought will be through online stores run by the provincial governments. It's become big business for those governments who expect to rake in millions of dollars dollars in tax revenues. Native groups across Canada are also looking for some of that revenue. In the West, some reserves have large tracts of land which can be used to grow cannabis. Darren Poorman is with the Kewakatoos First Nation in Saskatchewan. He says it's not just Indigenous people who will benefit.
We're going to need farm equipment. We're going to need all of these things to help create the right kind of crop. So the economic benefits are not only for First Nation people, but for all of the whole industry itself.
In other regions, some chiefs say the economic benefits are already being felt, creating badly needed jobs in their communities. Glenn Hudson is the chief of the Peguis First Nation in Manitoba.
People complain about us being a burden on taxpayers. Here's an opportunity for us to generate our own economic growth and sustainability.
Hudson says his reserve has partnered with a subsidiary of one of North America's biggest marijuana producers. The reserve has plans for a new retail store and pharmacy. But the issue is also a divisive one for First Nations communities. While some argue that marijuana would bring needed money and jobs, others say pot shops should not be allowed at all since they bring people to the community who are only looking for drugs. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Network.
And now it's time for your favorite weekly brain exercise, the point puzzle from KPOV Vend.
It's time for the puzzle.
Last week, I asked you to start with part of a house that begins with a Greek letter. Replace the Greek letter with a different Greek letter, and phonetically, you will have the last name of a former presidential candidate. Well, the answer is chimney. Replace the chi with a rho, and you get Romney. Our winner this week is Tara Ahmed, who listens to KPOV in Bend, Oregon. Keeping with the election theme this week, take the two major party candidates in a presidential race within the last 100 years, add an E and an H, and rearrange the letters to get 3 units of measurement. As an additional hint, you might use these measurements to measure your apples, your cucumbers, and your tractor. So again, take the two major party candidates in a presidential race, add an E and an H, and rearrange the letters to get 3 units of measurement. When you know the answer, send your name, your answer, and the station on which you hear the puzzle to puzzle@kpov.org. I'll select one winner from among any answers received by this Saturday.
Takes 2 cups to make 1 pint, 16 tablespoons to make 1 cup, 3 teaspoons to make a tablespoon in the jungle.
This has been Pearl Stark with your point puzzle for the week of October 22nd. The point puzzle is produced at KPOV High Desert Community Radio.
And now it's time for the daily newscast from the Public News Service, the service's bureaus in 36 states dedicated to news in the public interest. On today's episode, Trump buries the hatchet with former rival Ted Cruz. New Mexico voters face a tough choice over diversifying the state's economy. And Florida's environmental concerns prompt a new institute to inform the public.
The Public News Service daily newscast for Tuesday, October the 23rd, 2018. I'm Mike Clifford. Trump buries a hatchet with former rival Ted Cruz. Also on the Tuesday rundown, New Mexico's voters face a tough choice over diversifying the state's economy. Plus, Florida environmental concerns prompt a new institute to inform the public. Topping our news, a top aide to Crown Prince MBS orchestrated the brutal killings of Washington Post contributor Jamal Khashoggi via a Skype call. That, according to sources cited Monday by Reuters, the Daily Beast quotes a high-ranking Arab source as saying after Khashoggi was detained in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, his captors called Saud al-Qahtani via Skype. Eventually, according to a Turkish intelligence source, Qahtani told Khashoggi's captors to bring me the head of the dog. Meantime, President Trump said Monday he has buried the hatchet with his 2016 presidential rival, Ted Cruz of Texas, ahead of a campaign rally for the Republican lawmaker in Houston. The Hill quotes Trump as saying, "He's not Lion Ted anymore, he's Beautiful Ted."
The Hill added, Trump said, I like Ted, and asserted the Texas senator has locked down his tough re-election race against Democratic Representative Beto O'Rourke. A rebound in New Mexico's volatile oil and gas industry under the Trump administration is a major driver in next month's governor's race.
Democratic candidate Michelle Lujan Grisham has promised to deliver a renewable energy economy and 50% renewable production in the state by 2030. Republican candidate Steve Pierce also has promised diversification of the economy beyond oil and gas revenues, but Pierce, a former oil industry business owner, voted against investing in renewable energy while in Congress. Denise Foster with Conservation Voters New Mexico says finding new sources to fuel the state's needs is critical.
In this boom and bust cycle, we don't know how much revenue is going to come in every year, and that's why it's so important that we diversify our economy and so that it will affect every single person in the state.
The New Mexico Secretary of State's office says since early voting opened on Saturday, turnout has surged, with more than 72,000 people having already voted in the November 6th midterm election. I'm Roz Brown.
There are more than 1.2 million registered voters in the state. Democrats make up about 45%, followed by Republicans at 30, and Independents 27%. Social Security, Medicare, and health care are the most important issues for deciding how older Pennsylvanians will vote in this year's election. Andrea Sears clues us in on a new poll.
The poll conducted by AARP and Politico found protecting the future of Social Security, Medicare, and health care will be top priorities for more than 90% of voters age 50 and older as they go to the polls in 2 weeks. According to Bill Johnston Walsh, state director of AARP, older voters will be big factors in determining the outcome of many races.
50 plus is a large voting block, and they do vote year after year. And they're hearing what the rhetoric is down in Washington. They're watching people talk about cuts to Social Security and Medicare.
Similar majorities say they want elected officials to take action to lower health care and prescription drug costs.
Other states polled have included Arizona, Florida, and Ohio. On September the 30th, Congress allowed the Land and Water Conservation Fund to expire. Eric Tegenhoff reports some conservationists say the move has amplified voter concerns about the future of public lands heading into the midterm elections.
Amanda Wheelock with the Continental Divide Trail Coalition says while the environment typically takes a back seat to issues such as the economy and health care, public lands are especially important in Colorado.
So I think you see a lot of voters, regardless of whether they call themselves conservationists, out here in the Rocky Mountain West in general, and specifically in Colorado, that do really value the quality of life that public lands adds.
Wheelock says uncertainty about the Conservation Fund's future has created major roadblocks across the nation, including an effort to move a 14-mile section of the Continental Divide Trail off a dangerous highway near Steamboat Springs. Bills to restore the fund have cleared committee in both the U.S. House and Senate, but have yet to get a floor vote.
And finally, Tramell Gomes reports environmental concerns continue to rise in the Sunshine State. The University of Florida has opened a new research institute that aims to better educate Floridians about these concerns.
Florida's environment has been a large topic of discussion for the state's residents and politicians this election cycle. Now the Thompson Institute for Earth Systems at the University of Florida says it wants to make sure people are in the know about the latest environmental risks and development in the state. Bruce McFadden, a professor and director of the institute, says the newly opened facility aims to protect the state by informing the public on issues such as storm recovery.
Does it really make sense for us to rebuild in areas where the sea level is rising or where there, you know, potential for tropical storms? And hopefully we can better understand how to act responsibly in the future.
McFadden adds that he hopes his research also will find answers to issues such as tropical storm development, Florida's red tide outbreak, and an algal bloom that spread along both coasts, injuring Florida's wildlife and tourism industry.
A $10 million gift to the university by a Fort Myers couple, John and Beverly Thompson, provided the bulk of the funding for the new institute. It's expected to share the research for Florida's future generations, including elementary and high school students, to help improve the state's future. I'm Mike Clifford. Thanks for Newsin' and Cruisin' with Public News Service. We are member and listener supported, and we are online at publicnewsservice.org.
With former president and frontrunner Lula da Silva unable to run for president, Brazil's elections are turning sharply to the right. According to The Guardian and other news sources, Jair Bolsonaro looks set for a landslide victory over his Workers' Party rival, Fernando Haddad. Brazil, the world's fourth-largest democracy, votes on Sunday in the decisive second round of its presidential election. Bolsonaro says he expects to jail or exile his competition when he gets into power. In a chilling echo of the dirty war in the 1970s, conducted with documented guidance from the CIA, Bolsonaro said, quote, "These red outlaws will be banished from our homeland. It will be a cleanup the likes of which has never been seen in Brazilian history," unquote. Bolsonaro has also said that he will withdraw Brazil from the Paris Climate Accords following President Trump's lead. His followers are calling for a broad social backlash, calling feminists, quote, sexist. His rival, Fernando Haddad, told journalists in Rio Janeiro this week that looking at Bolsonaro from a democratic perspective, quote, "We are dealing with a barbarian."
Mexico is bracing for Hurricane Willa as it hits the Pacific coast between Mazatlan and Puerto Vallarta tonight. The storm had reached a Category 5 status at sea with winds in excess of 160 miles per hour, but is now striking the Mexican Pacific coast with Category 3 force. Willa is the sixth hurricane to undergo rapid intensification this season, adding 80 miles per hour to its winds over only a 24-hour period in the manner of Hurricanes Michael and Florence. It's expected to bring 125-mile-per-hour winds and a substantial storm surge to the coastal region. The Mazatlan government told drivers to avoid traveling on the roads after 3 p.m. local time due to expected winds of more than 110 miles per hour with even faster gusts. Satellite images show that the eye of the hurricane has passed directly over the Marias Islands, which are just offshore. There's a federal prison on the islands, but there are few permanent residents. Officials in Sinaloa State say they tried to evacuate 7,000 to 8,000 people from low-lying areas as the hurricane approached. The storm is hitting land in an area that changes sharply from beaches to mountainside, and the 6 to 18 inches of rain expected will likely produce dangerous flash flooding. The worst of the winds are apparently hitting San Blas as this news is broadcast.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, October 23rd, 2018. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Sam Bowman, Al Khan, and Annette Newell. The producer is myself, Kyle Carezzi, and our engineer is Sam Bowman. The interim directors of Evening News and Public Affairs are Sam Bowman and Teresa Mitchell. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath at 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Kyle Carezzi.
And I'm Annette Newell. Coming up tomorrow morning here on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on Wednesday Talk Radio, Paul welcomes journalist and activist Norman Solomon to the KBOO studios to dissect the Democratic Party and look for prospects of a revival. At 9, the radio activist talks to author Joshua Hunt about his book, University of Nike, How Corporate Cash Bought American Higher Education. At 10, Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And then at 11, the Recovery Zone welcomes environmental journalist Ben Goldfarb and beaver ambassador Stephen Mershall to discuss the roles beavers can play in environmental restoration. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. So if you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Measure 26200 for this year's midterm ballot is cited to limit campaign contributions to candidates. Here from Honest Elections to discuss it is Moses Ross. Hello, welcome to the station.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
So, in a nutshell, tell us what the measure will do if it's passed.
Well, in essence, the elevator speech is it will get big money out of politics and it will level the playing field. Because right now, as it stands, it's very challenging for grassroots based candidates to be able to afford and to run for office, given the high expenses that are involved in running a campaign in Oregon, because of the fact that there are no contribution caps in the state of Oregon. Now, Oregon is not an outlier. Is an outlier, because 44 other states in the United States have some form of campaign contribution caps. There's only four or five states, you know, the remaining states that do not have it, and Oregon is one of those. And because of that, you have seen an explosion over the last decade of contribution or of campaign related costs, necessary fundraising. We have so many elected officials that are complaining that they spend so much time of the day not doing the work of the people, but making phone calls to try to finance their reelection campaigns. Mm-hmm. And it's a standard thing. Mm-hmm. They have to sit in front of a phone for a couple of hours and kiss the ring, as I call it, mm-hmm. to try to get enough money to be able to stave off other candidates and to get reelected. You know, I give you a very quick example. You know, it used to be back in the 90s that it would cost less than $30,000 to run a state representative campaign. Nowadays, the most recent election in 2016, they were spending over $750,000 for a state rep campaign. Wow. And that is just for a universe of maybe 12,000 to 15,000 voters. Yeah. So you can imagine what that per vote cost equates to.
And the job pays much less than...
legislators don't even make minimum wage.
Yeah.
I mean, they make less than $16,000 a year. So here they are raising money for a campaign to get a job that will put them into poverty. And it kind of creates an environment where only those that are self-employed, only those that have well connections, good connections, that can raise that kind of money can actually even run for office. And so we're trying to change that here slowly but surely in the state of Oregon. 2 years ago, we were able to get a change to the charter of Multnomah County and put campaign finance reform actions codified in the charter. It passed by 89% approval by voters in Multnomah County. So we have learned from that campaign and clarified a few things in the City of Portland measure. And now we're election day. We're hoping that it has that same sort of a resolving approval, and that people, the voters, see the need for this.
Yeah, but even if it passes, it's likely to face a lot of court challenges, just as the Multnomah County one right now. It's, I guess, that under the Oregon Supreme Court, they're saying that parts of it are not even constitutional.
Yeah, and that's the interesting thing. You know, we realize that the mm-hmm. campaign contribution cap is because of a Oregon Supreme Court ruling that was made back in the 90s with a totally different makeup of the Supreme Court at the time. And just like anything that we need to press to make affect change, we feel that these measures will be the vehicle to get a reassessment of that ruling in a new Supreme Court that is much more receptive to these types of contribution caps.
And what's the specific cap? What is the maximum that a person can donate to a candidate, and what's the maximum for an organization that they can donate to a candidate?
So see, now that's a great question. Okay, so right now, I like to use the analogy of a three-legged stool when it comes to our measure. The first is the campaign contribution caps. It will limit candidates to receiving contributions of $500 or less. The second part of that, the second leg of that stool, is defining who can make those contributions. And so it does not allow contributions from corporations and other entities. So, but what it does do is it creates what's called a small donor committee. And small donor committees is made up, it accepts contributions from individuals in the amount of $100 or less. And so these small donor committees can be funded through individuals, once again, not corporations, individual voters, at $100 maximum. And it allows for the pooling of the money to be able to make purchases, to be able to get the word out. And so another restriction that it applies is that it limits independent expenditures. So in other words, groups that are promoting a candidate, but not directly with the campaign per se. They're outside groups that have an interest in getting someone elected. These independent expenditures, they're capped at $5,000 a year. And it also limits political committees' independent expenditures per race to $10,000 a year. And it must be funded by contributions from individuals of 500 or less. So once again, what we're doing here is we're shifting the playing field. Now, of course, there's going to be institutional resistance to any kind of a change to an environment that people have been using for 20 years plus, especially if you are an integral part of that system, like many of these elected officials are. But when you're on the outside looking in and you see these fantastic candidates that are out there in the grassroots that you just know for a fact could do a much better job than the elected official that we have it there, that then you start to see the benefit of what we're doing here. And this creates an environment where that grassroots candidate that is competent, that is intelligent, that is in touch with voters and in touch with the community can get out there and actually have a viable shot at leading this city. And so this measure is meant to affect City of Portland elections. So the mayor's race, the city council race, auditor, those will be under the purview of it. We already have it in Multnomah County, and it affects the commissioner race, the chair's race, the sheriff's race over there. So when this passes, all of Multnomah County, including City of Portland, will be under these constraints. And so what's exciting is that we welcome any kind of a legal challenge to this because we, you know, quite frankly, we want to have the Supreme Court take another good look at this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And nationally, you know, the Supreme Court and Citizens United, they basically are saying that corporations are people. So it seems like these kind of measures, even though they have a lot of public support, they still have a lot of challenges in the legal system.
Agreed. And, you know, we're really fortunate with our group, our humble group, that we have volunteer attorneys that are willing to do what's necessary to make sure that we continue that legal challenge. And, you know, quite frankly, we're going forward with this regardless. On 2020, we have just gotten the word that we can start collecting signatures for a statewide campaign finance reform measure in 2020. And we feel very optimistic, especially after we do really well here in 2 weeks. You combine that with the momentum that we had from Multnomah County and the 89% there. It's time.
Mm-hmm. Now, I was flipping through the voter pamphlet here, and Honest Elections pulled results about measuring corruption in government, and they used a grading system. And I'll read some of them real quick. Public access to information got an F. Political financing, F. Executive accountability, F. Legislative accountability, D-. Procurement, F. Lobbying disclosure, F. Ethics enforcement agencies, F. So my question is, how can corruption in government be measured?
Well, I think it can be measured through the inertia for change.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, just coming from my gut there, I think that's how you would measure it. Because if everything is still the same, if it's still the status quo, and we're still getting these races that millions of, you know, that only millionaires can run for, that's right there is another reason that we need to do this, because we have to shift that power center, you know, back to the people. And mm-hmm. That's really, really how I feel about that.
Moses, could you tell us about this group, Honest Elections?
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm proud to be a part of the Honest Elections group, because I am a hardcore Democrat. I'm involved in the state. I'm involved in the county party. And I have come and found common ground with my brethren in the independent parties and the progressive parties here in Oregon. Dan Meek is one of our volunteer attorneys, and he is just an amazing man and a heck of an attorney. And we are all come together on this common goal. And I think it's indicative of what can happen when you start to focus in politics on the common values versus tribalism and party affiliation and all the current gut reactions that people have with it. You know, this is an issue that transcends party politics. And I know that there are Republicans out there that feel the same way that I do, that, mm-hmm. you know, we can all work together to get these basic changes made to empower the people.
And what sort of things has Honest Elections done to campaign for the measure to get passed?
Oh, my goodness. We have been out there canvassing. We have lawn signs, high visibility locations. We are doing a mailing. You know, unfortunately, we're under the same campaign structure still that everyone else is. And, you know, if you are inclined, we accept donations to help fund this. Honest-elections.com is where you can learn more about it. You know, if you can throw us a $25 bill or more, we'll spend it wisely. So we're definitely getting the word out, and we've been working with affiliated groups. This was endorsed by the Multnomah County Democratic Party, and they've been kind enough to put their endorsement on all of their slate cards. There's 60,000 slate cards that they're passing out throughout the neighborhoods all throughout Portland, saying that they endorse us, and we proudly put their logo on our flyers. The Bernie PDX, the Progressive Left group, they're doing the exact same thing. You know, we're working with coalitions here. And once again, that's what's exciting about it, is that these coalitions are all coming together under the same roof, under a common cause. You know, this can set a precedent, I feel, for other good things to happen.
And it's also been endorsed by the Oregonian Editorial Board.
Say hallelujah.
Yeah. And but yet, with the caveat of it's all about the long game. Like, don't expect it to change everything overnight.
I agree with that. I'm glad to see that they are realistic enough to realize that. You know, we certainly are. You know, that this is a situation that does require looking at the long term here. And, you know, in an ideal situation, we'd be like Seattle, and we'd have what they call those democracy bucks, where individual voters are given, $100 in this script that they can give directly to a candidate, encouraging a candidate to go out and talk to voters to try to get that $100 donation from them, you know, and they don't have to give it all to them. They can give 50 of it to one guy, person, and 150 to another person. You know, I love that. That's the incentive that's missing in our campaign finance reform. And once again, using the stool analogy, the three-legged stool that we have here is campaign contribution, caps, definitions of who can contribute, and then we also have disclosure. We require in this measure that the top five contributors to a campaign must be on all advertising. So it's steps like that to help us get that transparency. And then you add on top of that public funding, where a person can go out there and generate the funds by talking to voters versus talking to special interests. Man, democracy at work.
Now, as we start to wrap up soon, is there anything you want to add as we close off?
Oh, just remember to vote yes for 26-200. Tell your friends, make sure to talk to 10 people. And, you know, regardless of how you feel about campaign finance reform, this is such an important election. Mm-hmm. I mean, don't stay at home. Get your friends, get 10 of your friends, make a commitment to get those people out there to vote. And while you're out there, vote yes for campaign finance reform if you live in the city of Portland.
Okay. Yeah, I know other folks in other countries, when I've traveled, I've noticed that they've said that they seem to think our system is a little crazy. Like in the UK, they already have very specific campaign laws about how much money you can spend and how much you can contribute, and they think that otherwise it's not really a democracy. I mean, so in other countries, that's kind of, they look at our system and think it's a little nuts.
Oh, I can see why. Yeah. And, you know, that's why we're trying to make it a little bit more sane, at least in this little slice of the world that we live in, that we can work within. And I feel really confident that, you know, this will be the second step in a three-step process to get it statewide.
All right. Moses okay. Ross of Honest Elections, thank you for joining us for KBOO.
Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank
nice you.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Alebrijes, the Milagro Theater annual Día de los Muertos theater production, running weekly on Thursday, Friday, Saturdays, and Sundays until November 11th at the Milagro Theater in Portland. Alebrijes is a family-friendly production of real-life artist and Alebrijes creator Pedro Linares, delves into his world and fictionalizes it to create this Día de los Muertos story. Full of mythical creatures, psychedelic jungles, song, dance, and larger-than-life puppetry. Again, that's Alebrijes, the Milagro Theater annual Día de los Muertos theater production, running weekly on Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sundays until November 11th at the Milagro Theater, 525 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Speak Up for the Climate, Our Future is a Constitutional Right, on Monday, October 29th at 11:30 a.m. at Terry Schrunk Plaza in Portland. Speak Up for Climate supports the young plaintiffs in the historic Juliana versus United States court case. The event will feature music, art, relationship, and momentum building for local youth interconnections in action. Again, that's Speak Up for the Climate, Our Future is a Constitutional Right, on Monday, October 29th at 11:30 a.m. at Cherry Shrunk Plaza, 431 Southwest Madison Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from the League of Women Voters of Portland, providing unbiased election information online, featuring a personalized guide including candidate answers to questions, explanations of ballot measures, and links to recorded candidate interviews and nonpartisan voter forums. More information can be found at vote411.org. Next up is Preference with our host, Hedda.